Pleased to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Going to take a look now at science, science research, science education. Certainly, we invite you to join in as we visit with Bassam Shakashiri, Madison, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA, and Director of the Initiative for Science Literacy. Certainly, if you want to join in with a question about science, research, or education, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And Bassam, welcome back.
Happy to be with you, Larry.
Last Friday was the 25th anniversary of what's called A Nation at Risk. And that, again, was a report during the Reagan era, a Blue Ribbon panel that alerted us to the weak performance of our educational system. Are we still a nation at risk?
Yes, indeed, we are. This was a clarion call that was issued by the Secretary of Education Commission that he had appointed, Secretary Bell. In 1981, he appointed a commission to look into the status of education in the country. And the report is a bold report. It's really called attention to a lot of important issues in our society. And interestingly enough, the President Reagan initially did not want to embrace this report because, among other things, on the agenda was the elimination of the Department of Education. But this report was eventually announced by the president and has resulted in a lot more serious attention being given to education, and in particular to science and mathematics education, but all of education. Yes, the nation is at risk because we have to be vigilant in paying attention to educational issues. We have to be careful about the courses that we offer to our students. We have to be very aware of new knowledge that comes. We have to be aware of what it takes to communicate effectively with students, to inspire students. So we are at risk because science and technology are advancing at a very rapid rate, and there's a big gap between those who are scientifically literate and those who are science illiterate. Excuse me. It's allergy season, Larry. My allergies are acting up. So the risk is not only to our nation. The title of this report is Nation at Risk. I would say people at risk. Mm-hmm. Because issues that affect the quality of education have consequences that that don't know geographic boundaries. The important message here is that we have to be always vigilant and paying attention to what goes on in our educational systems. Now, we live in a country, and I'm very proud to be a U.S. citizen. We live in a country where we don't have a centralized educational office or department. Education is the responsibility of states. There are, of course, over 16,000 school districts. There are over 3,500 colleges and universities. And each one of them can do their own thing, so to speak. But there are important national standards that were published about 15 years after the issuing of the Nation at Risk report, national science education standards, national mathematics educational standards. They're not federal standards. They're national standards. And states have followed suit in putting them into effect. Yet the nation is still at risk. The people are still at risk because the quality of teachers and the number of qualified teachers is very, very much at risk. We don't have as many high-quality teachers as we need in our school systems. Please don't misunderstand. This is not about bashing teachers. No. I'm a strong advocate of supporting teachers. But the truth is, society does not support teachers as much as they should be supported. And this is a situation that requires careful attention so that future generations, our children, grandchildren, will learn how to enjoy these great advances in science and technology that we have now, and also learn how to deal with those advances. Most of these advances can be put to good use.
Sure.
But they also can be put to bad use.
Yeah.
And hence, it is very important for us to listen carefully to what this report. It's a small little pamphlet, A Nation at Risk, was published in 1984. And I am glad to be observing its anniversary here. You know, anniversaries, like birthdays, they are times for they're time markers.
Yeah.
And they're times for reflection and think about what is it that we want to enjoy in terms of what has been accomplished in the past, but more importantly, what we want to do next. And so it's really critical as we mark the 25th anniversary of Nation at Risk to think about what we are likely to do, what we must do, what we ought to do in the next 5 to 10 to 15, indeed the next 25 years.
Well, we have a number of people who would like to visit with you, Bassam, so I'm going to go to the phones and begin with Dennis in St. Croix Valley. Dennis, hi, thank you for calling.
Well, thanks to you and your show and your guests and so forth. I'm concurring with your guests here, but a little different perspective. I think it is time for review. And I think it's time to review how we're using science to make money virtually with no questions asked. And I think what we got to start reviewing about pesticides produced by science, fertilizers, plastics, they're distributed through all our oceans. You know, we've got a real thing to look at, not just look at what we've accomplished and how we can move ahead.
Indeed, Dennis, part of our accomplishment is to be responsible for the use of what these products are and how we are careful in their effect on the environment, an effect on health, effect on society at large. So, yes, it's not just advancing science knowledge and advancing technology, but being careful in what we use and how we use it, and also be aware of our role as custodians of this very precious planet that we all live on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Dennis, for calling. Ned in Wausau will give you a chance. Hi, Ned.
Hi. I wanted to bring up something that was in the news today, and that was the intelligent design controversy in the state of Florida was in the news. And I wanted to just bring up what is a scientific theory. From my understanding as a professor of biology in the UW system, a scientific theory is a testable and correctable explanation that is observable and yields new information about nature. And what scientists do is they design experiments, often with experimentals that receive a treatment, and controls that don't receive that treatment. And so what we've got in the theory of evolution is something that is testable as far as the mechanism of the basic mechanism of how it comes about with natural selection.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've got with intelligent design is essentially this basically a literature search looking for the weaknesses of the theory of evolution. And so, therefore, it does not have the criteria of being testable. You can't set up an experiment and test it. It's not observable because you can't observe intelligent design by setting up an experiment to look at it. It's not correctable because God is all-powerful and all-knowledgeable, and you can't correct that source. And finally, it yields no new information about nature. So therefore, intelligent design is not within the realm of science. And if it's taught, I don't have any objection to that as long as it's in a religious classroom rather than in a scientific classroom. And a lot of people just don't understand what is science and what is not science.
You're absolutely right, Ned. A lot of people don't understand the distinction between beliefs and between science. And let me just say at the outset here that intelligent design and creation science, so-called creation science, they're not scientific. They're not part of scientific inquiry. They're not part of science. They are parlayed this way. In fact, there's a movie that Ben Stein, I think, is the person behind this movie that tries to promote intelligent design as being scientific and so on. You mentioned something in the newspaper today from Florida. In today's New York Times, in the science section, there's an interview with Francisco Ayala, who is an evolutionary biologist at the University of California in Irvine. And he and others have written an excellent small pamphlet about evolution published by the National Academy of Sciences. It's on the web. If you go to my website, which is www.scifun.org, S-C-I-F-U-N.org, you will find in the upper right corner, if you click there, you'll find a direct link to that publication. This is an important point that you raise, Ned, in terms of being informed and being aware of the role of beliefs, religious beliefs, as well as the role of science in our society. I should mention very quickly that Francisco Ayala himself is a former priest. In any event, the points that you raise are very relevant to what we must be vigilant about in terms of what passes as science or what people propose to pass as science in a course that is taught in schools and what we should be careful about not including as being science when in fact it's not science. So I agree with you. We should learn about people's beliefs, about their religious beliefs, about traditions, but we should be careful about how not only we label those courses where these materials are taught, but also be careful to make a distinction between science and what is not science.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling, Ned. Appreciate it. Dan in White Lake is up next. Dan, morning. Hello.
Good morning. The other day I heard a program where a chap from England was talking about experiments there to try and turn coal into gasoline. Is coal nothing more than fossilized oil?
Coal is carbon, and gasoline is a mixture of hydrocarbons. There are processes by which you gasification processes to turn charcoal into usable hydrocarbons. And these processes are not new. They're old. There are indeed ways by which that can be done. The real question is, do we want to keep depending so much on these fossil fuels for our energy usage, or do we want to realistically consider alternative energy sources? We should be careful when we talk about ethanol as a substance that can be used instead of gasoline or sources of energy coming from biofuels. We should look at this very carefully and make sure that at least a couple of things. One is that the cost is that there is a cost effectiveness consideration here, but we also need to be concerned about the production of greenhouse gases because all combustible materials that contain carbon produce carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide is one of the main culprits that contributes to global warming and also has other dire manifestations that we should be careful about. But yes, the direct answer to your question, Dan, is yes, it is indeed possible to turn coal into useful hydrocarbons.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, as we talk science and science education with Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in our conversation as we talk science and science research and education with Bassam Shakashiri at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Jeff in Madison is up next, Bassam, so let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I work for the university and in one of the science departments, and it's sad that the elementary school teachers, but our future teachers, really don't get as much scientific training as would be ideal. There are, however, some real interesting venues in the state of Wisconsin. We are so blessed with the UW Extension that's in all our counties, especially, and I have to kind of go rah-rah here, I'm a 4-H leader also, and the science programs that every county has in 4-H and through Extension are just amazing. They're usually run by volunteer, professional, or amateur, or sometimes retired scientists. These are people who have a great deal of enthusiasm for their subject, and they love teaching children. Now, I'm from Sauk County, and we have things like the Youth Environmental Project, where the kids really get out and do hands-on science in the woods, in the fields, in the marshes. It's amazing. We have an astronomy program. We have lots of things. If you feel that your children aren't getting the science education they should, it might be as close by as just calling up your local 4-H agent. Thanks much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Bassam, comment?
Thank you, Jeff. Yes, indeed. We belong to a very rich community in terms of offerings that are available to us, and we should take advantage of those offerings. 4-H and other so many other extension activities from the UW system and other institutions of higher education in Wisconsin, indeed in our entire listening area here. But these should not be used as a substitute for what goes on in the classroom. I think we need to be vigilant, as I said earlier, about the quality of science courses, mathematics courses, as well as other courses that are offered in the school systems, so that we are sure that we are giving our students, through our teachers and through the school system, the very best offerings that we can make in science. I'm quite concerned about the elimination of laboratory work in many science courses. It's being some of these courses, some of the schools are offering courses without a hands-on, minds-on experience for students. Science is an experimental human activity. We need to encourage hands-on activities. We need to encourage minds-on programs so that we don't have courses about science, but we have courses in science. But the community involvement is essential. Parental involvement is essential. The parents going with their children to the zoo or to the botanical garden or to look at the at a swamp or a river or a lake. Science is all around us, and how we view the environment that we're in, how we learn about the environment that we're in, will determine actually the quality of our own life in the society that we belong to. So I agree with Jeff that we should take advantage of what's available, but we should also be focusing on what is going on in the classrooms.
Mm-hmm. And again, I thank you, Jeff, for calling. Mike in Madison is up next, so let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hello, good morning. I want to ask you a simple, very simple question. I want to know in layman's language, what is global warming, why it is bad for us, and what are greenhouse gases? Is it blocking the sun rays from the sun into the earth? Why is it bad?
All right. Thank you very much for calling.
Very good question, Mike. Let me try to address what are greenhouse gases and what do they do? I think everyone is familiar with the greenhouse effect. Now, if you, in the summertime, for example, you park your car, you roll up the windows, when you come back, it's hotter inside the car than it is outside the car. If you look in our state of Wisconsin, throughout the state, you see greenhouses where agricultural products are grown. And so here's what happened. The sun rays hit the surface of the earth, and the energy some of it is converted into heat. And this heat does not escape from the surface of the planet. Why doesn't it escape? Because there are gases, and I'll mention four of them. Carbon dioxide is one of them. Methane is the second one. And nitrous oxide, N2O, is the third one. And the fourth one is water vapor. Mm-hmm. These gases act as traps for the heat that is bouncing off the surface of the earth, and they tend to increase the temperature of the planet. When the temperature goes up slightly, then more water is lost through evaporation. But when water evaporates, it turns into water vapor, which itself is a greenhouse gas. Why are these gases greenhouse gases? Because the energies of the components that make them up, the carbon, the oxygen, the hydrogen, the nitrogen, they correspond to the wavelengths of the radiation that is being reflected off the surface of the earth. Of course, the sun rays, when they come through to the surface of the earth, they also lose some of the heat because the gases are there. So it works both ways. Some people mistakenly say that ozone is a greenhouse gas. In fact, even people in my class, we know because we talk about this in my class, ozone is not a greenhouse gas. Ozone is a substance that is harmful on the surface of the planet, but very beneficial to us way up in the stratosphere. Why is it beneficial? Because the sun energy, the sun rays energy, break up the oxygen bonds in ozone, and that because the energy corresponds to that, it's in the ultraviolet region, and the UV radiation that hits the surface of the earth can be harmful to us. So ozone acts as a layer in the upper atmosphere, but not in the lower atmosphere, and ozone is not a greenhouse gas. So basically, the greenhouse gases trap the heat, and they keep it near the surface of the earth, and this is the major contribution to what is called global warming. So it is using models. It is anticipated that the temperature of the planet on the surface will rise by several degrees Celsius, anywhere from 2 to 3 to 4, maybe even higher. And the consequences of this are not very good for us. So why are we concerned about this? Because we've been producing a lot of carbon dioxide through the combustion of fossil fuels. Methane is, you know, that's natural gas. That's all over the place. That's marsh gas, too. But we have made, in the past 2 centuries, we have increased the total amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that is the main culprit for global warming as a result of carbon dioxide being a greenhouse gas.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I think we lost Mike, but I thank you very much for calling, and good description. Thanks, Bassam. Jeff in River Falls has something that might relate to that. Jeff, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting program.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah, in relationship to that last question, why is this such a controversy? I have really very good friends who call global warming a hoax, and you know, as a educator, how do we educate our kids about global warming and the influence of human activity? That seems to be where the controversy is, that there seems to be some scientists on one side say that human activity is causing global warming, and then some say that they do and they don't. So how can we get that cleared up for ourselves and for our students?
Another good question, Jeff. Thank you.
I'll get it off the line.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. So the issue is that these discoveries that are being made now of the effect of these greenhouse gases. Some people don't know about them. And ignorance is really our biggest enemy. So I would say there is no doubt among the vast majority of scientists that global warming is real. There's no doubt about that. There are people who question the data. There are people who raise questions that, you know, there are skeptics. That's okay. This is how science works. It's not permanent dogma. It is subject to scrutiny. It's subject to inquiry. It's subject to investigation. So, but as I say, there is very little doubt, if any, that global warming is real. And so what we have to do is inform ourselves so that we can inform others as to what the issues are and what our carbon footprint is and how much we actually depend on the use of fossil fuels for so many different forms of energy. There was an article in the paper the other day about kiwi fruit and how you can get kiwi, you know, from China or Australia almost instantly. You know, it's yeah. flown over. Well,
sure.
And so how does it get here? It gets here through huge transport vehicles, airplanes, that burn what? kerosene and other hydrocarbons. And so that has an effect on what we do. It practically everything that we do has an effect on the environment. You know, using the internet, it's estimated that the internet uses about 3 to 3.5% of the total energy that is generated. Now, that's a significant
that's
amount.
That's a lot.
So awareness, Jeff, being informed, being also skeptical. I think that's very good in terms of having an intelligent conversation with others, whether they are members of your family or they are neighbors or anyone in the community about these issues. I think that's very, very much at the heart of how we can learn more about these issues and then come, I hope, to some intelligent decisions to deal with them.
And thanks very much for calling, Jeff. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. We're talking science and science research and education today with Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry. Pleased to have him along and have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. Or in Madison, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And we'd like to have you join in. Appreciate it very much. We'll take some more calls here in just a minute. But before we go back to the phone, there's been a lot about, what is it, bisphenol A? Is that
bisphenol.
Yeah. Bisphenol A. And whether or not that should be banned. And maybe you could give us a background on that, Bassam, before we go back to the
Not too long ago, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel had an excellent series about bisphenol A, which is a chemical used in the manufacturing of a lot of polymers, a lot of products that we use. There was a recent report from Canada saying that they're going to ban its use in Canada because baby bottles have in them this small amounts of bisphenol A, and it gets leached, and then it's harmful.
Yeah.
So the EPA is investigating and trying to decide whether or not the United States regulatory agencies should ban the use of bisphenol A. It's used in manufacturing a lot of common chemicals that we depend on. Polycarbonate, you know, these water bottles that people use are made of polycarbonates, and they contain bisphenol A because it's used in the manufacturing of these substances. So infant care products are being looked at very carefully.
Very carefully.
And, you know, it's very important in this regard not to be totally alarmist about this. I think we should let the regulatory agencies benefit from the results of scientific research and testing that relates to health issues before making a decision. So I really salute the Milwaukee paper for having started this reporting earlier this year, and I think it is important for us to learn what bisphenol is, why it's there, and what are the adverse effects of having it. And if they are truly adverse, we should remove it from the market.
William and Viola, it's your turn now. Hi, William.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
In terms of carbon footprint, I'm running off the grid up here with a couple of windmills and diesel generator on a French factories, but I want to get to the point. In the European system, I mean, they go to high school, and by the time they're in 12th grade here, they either go into a vocational system or go to college. And they use their educational system is used percentage-wise much more so than ours. We got too much time during the summertime for these kids to have to go back to school and start all over again. I would like to see us go to school full time, and that's my opinion on that.
All right. Well, let's see what Bassam has to share.
It's a good observation, William. I will tell you again immediately. The educational systems that we have in the United States are superior to anything else that's available around the world. Why? Because we have freedom of choice. We are free to go to school as long as we want to. Your question is, why don't we go to school longer? I mean, why don't we exercise the freedom to go to school longer? And this has historical origins. So the question is, why is the school year 180 days long? Well, in the old agrarian society of, you know, a century and a half, 2 centuries ago, the youngsters, they were needed in the summertime.
They had to work on the farm.
Had to work on the farm, and it wasn't easy to work on the farm in the wintertime. So that's why we have 180 days of in the school year. Now, does that mean we're stuck with it? No. Does it mean that people like William should talk to their school board and to state educational agencies about increasing a number of school days? Yes. Does it mean that the teachers' union should address these issues? Yes. These are all important societal issues that we in the best democratic society in the history of humankind. We're not a perfect democratic society. Mm-hmm. We are the best society in the history of humankind. If we don't take responsibility that goes along with the freedom that we have to address the specific questions like the one William is raising, then we're making a mistake. So, for example, if you increase from 180 days to 200 days, what would you do in the extra 20 days? So this causes us to examine the purposes for which we have our educational systems, whether it is at the pre-college level or at the college level. I mean, why is the semester 16 weeks long at UW-Madison, for example?
Yeah.
Why don't we have 3 semesters? There are institutions that have tri-semesters, and people go in during
quarterly system, too.
Some people have quarterly systems. So my point is, William is asking, are there ways by which we can do things differently? And yes, there are ways. If we take the initiative and we examine what else is being done elsewhere and what works for us and how we can make it better, that's what our democratic society is really all about.
And Carolyn in Green Bay is up next. So let's go to Carolyn. Hi, thank you for waiting.
Oh, you're welcome. Hi, Bassam.
Hi, Carolyn.
Well, it's wonderful to talk to you, and I appreciate the fact that you make chemistry interesting and fun, much more than my high school chemistry teacher did. I'm calling about my son, who is just finishing his sophomore year at UW-Stevens Point as a chemistry major, and he is extremely worried about what he's going to do with his major when he gets out. So maybe you can give him a little advice.
I'd be happy to. If one becomes a chemistry major, if one becomes a science major, but let's talk about a chemistry major, that really is very empowering. There are lots of things that one can do. You can get a job in industry. You can go to graduate school. You can go to law school with a strong background in science. You can go to, into business. There are lots of opportunities. So learning the technical details, the technical aspects of chemistry, indeed of science, is a very empowering experience. And there are ways by which one can find out more detailed information about career opportunities. I would say, Carolyn, your son and anyone else listening to us here should talk to the professors at the university, get some advice, get some information from the placement office. All universities have a placement office. Mm-hmm. Talk to a counseling, the guidance counselor, if you are in high school or middle school. Ask the same question that you're asking me. What are the opportunities? What can I do if I am a science major, if I am a chemistry major? I would say
A lot of opportunities.
Lots of opportunities. And we have to be very careful in finding out the reliable information about such opportunities. Mm-hmm. I would also say that parental encouragement is very important. So what you're doing—
I appreciate the fact that you are just right now telling him almost the same thing that I have been telling him.
Ah, good.
But my real hope is that he can come to UW-Madison and study in graduate school with you.
Well, he has to apply, you know. he has to apply, and we're always happy to have people come to our graduate programs, and we're very, very proud of the quality of the students that we get. So thank you for that, Carolyn.
Yeah, thanks, Carolyn.
Thank you.
And good luck to your son. Appreciate it very much. And Jody and Racine, I think, is up with a question or comment. Jody, hi.
Hi. I'd like you to elaborate a little bit on what you just said about the internet usage. Does that mean staying logged on? Some people stay logged on for 24 hours day after day. Or does that mean just using? Can you explain a little bit? Because that's something I didn't realize.
Yeah. Well, the fact that the internet is now so widely used for commerce, for business, for educational purposes, for entertainment, that means that it requires a certain amount of energy, electrical energy. And this electrical energy has to be generated somehow. Mm-hmm. It's usually generated through burning fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
By burning the fossil fuel, and then you have the heat energy, then you run a turbine and mm-hmm. you generate electricity. So that's what I meant. I don't think there's any way in which we go back not to use the internet. I was just pointing out that in the past 15, 20 years, this great advance in technology, the internet, it does not come without a cost.
Yeah. And in some ways, you think you hope that maybe their other costs go down because of the internet use going up. But that's another topic for another day. But Sam, thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
And again, I want to publish your or promote your website too, because I know you always get lots of hits after a show. And it's a great place to go for a lot of wonderful information about science.
Our Science is Fun website is scifun.org, and we answer all kinds of questions that come up, except one type. We don't answer homework questions.
Okay. Thanks, Basav.
Thank you, Larry.
Basav Shakashiri is UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry and William T. Avu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA. He directs the Initiative for Science Literacy, and we're really pleased to have him with us. Coming up, we're going to take a look at rail safety issues in Wisconsin with Rod Cronin, Wisconsin's Commissioner of Railroads. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.